count down will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday, the 10th of June, in the glorious future year of 2023. And what do I have to talk about today? Well, the first piece of news is that I have the strange payphone jukebox thing I've been talking about for a while. It's completely working now. And I promised to do a Hacker Public Radio episode once I got it working, so I better buckle down and do that. Now, I'm hoping to make that a part of the big atomic energy exhibit that I'm planning to put on at the North American Science Fiction Convention in Winnipeg, which is in July. More specifically, it's the 20th through the 23rd of July. Well, the glorious 20th of July. That implies that I should put on also a space display of some kind. And of course, I'm well equipped to put on space displays. Definitely thinking about the six big panels of Kelly Free's artwork. I'm afraid I'm likely to get into some controversy with one of them that shows the, you know, caravels and the motto, "What if Isabella had said no?" Because, of course, particularly, you know, there are a lot of people who are trying to put more emphasis on, you know, respecting indigenous peoples and their perspectives and so on, and their perspective might be somewhat more negative toward Columbus than that of other people. And social attitudes in the past half century, frankly, have shifted somewhat negative toward Columbus compared, and the whole European contact thing, compared to where they were when Kelly Freese made the posters. But I think I'm going to show it anyway, right? I'm not just going to leave out one of the six. So, also, I think I will bring my big panel, which you may never have seen. I've got to take some photos of it and post them. My big panel of space-themed postal covers, mostly from the early 1960s to the early 1970s, which does include the Black Arrow launch, the one and only British Empire in Space satellite launch, the completely British-made satellite and booster launched from a launch site in Australia. You know, for those of you who are into steampunk and the thought of the British Empire in Space, this is as close as it ever got, right? This is the closest we ever got. So that is going to be a part, that is going to be a display that I put on also. I have to say, at this point, the biggest challenge is I've got to acquire a sufficient supply of tokens for the payphones, And what they accept is German mark coins. And I could buy German mark coins in considerable quantities, but I'd have to pay about 50 cents a piece for them, plus shipping from somewhere, because they're still redeemable in Germany for approximately 49 euro cents. And so if you buy mark coins, you gotta pay the monetary value. Fortunately, British copper nickel shillings and 5p coins are just slightly larger in size and weight. Also, the New Zealand 10-cent coins up until recently, the Australian 10-cent coins still, and a number of other, you know, Irish shillings and 5p coins. Anyway, there are quite a number of coins of the same size and weight and composition as the British copper nickel shilling, and as it turns out, they work just fine. I'd read about this, that people were using them in the 70s to slug cigarette machines and so on in Germany. But I wasn't sure whether it would work with the somewhat more sophisticated coin discriminating mechanism of these payphones. As it turns out, it does. So what I need is bulk quantities, probably several hundred. I mean, currently I have, 20 or so, and just in testing it, you know, I've been running through them and having to unlock the cash box, dig out the coins, been trying to get to the, there wasn't anything to be had at the, there was like 10, 12 coins to be had at the Texas Numismatic Association show last weekend. I went to the Fort Worth Coin Company, which is a local coin shop here, and they had almost nothing in the way of what's known as junk box, cheap foreign material. I got like one Deutschmark coin and one other thing that worked, shilling or a Barbados 25-cent piece or something like that. Anyway, so I have to put enough of those together that I can actually do it, you know, actually have a supply of tokens to work the phone. And of course, what I want to have is also a mechanism that people feed in like a Canadian dollar coin and get out a couple of these tokens. And so it remains to be seen how that will be done, whether I can rent like a capsule vending machine or in Winnipeg from a party supply place, or whether I'm going to have to build a coin-operated coin dispensing machine. Fortunately, coin mechanisms are fairly easy to get on eBay. And so, fully electronic ones, and I could program one to send out, like, 2 pulses for a loonie and 5 pulses for a toonie, and use those pulses to operate a string of solenoids, which would kick the tokens out from tubes. Anyway, you don't want to know that kind of detail, or if you do, you know, we can follow up later. Because there's stuff to talk about. Some of the stuff I have to talk about comes out the Wall Street Journal. Now, the first thing is, the other day I was glancing at the Wall Street Journal and said, wow, I didn't realize they'd started using AI to write their articles, because this article began, Dorlisa Flur, D-O-R-L-I-S-A-F-L-U-R, as though it were a person's name, Dorlisa Flur lived in a cookie-cutter house in a suburban subdivision, and I'm thinking, my God. Every Friday, I guess it is. Anyway, they have a section about housing from the perspective of people who would read a housing section entitled Mansion. There was also a thing in there about Japanese architect Tadao Ando, who designed the Museum of Modern Art, the new one in Fort Worth. Anyway, and there was some brief remark about Tadao Ando, his concrete houses cost far more to construct than conventional houses. I was thinking, that can't be right. Reinforced concrete is very cheap construction material. That's why it's used for large projects where anything else would be far too expensive. And I thought about it a minute and said, but the key is, reinforced concrete construction is cheap if you reuse the formwork. Or if you are using extremely cheap formwork like sono tubes, which you can get at the hardware store. They're these basically giant toilet paper tubes. You auger a hole in the ground, you shove a sono tube down in it, you fill it, you put rebar and aggregate in there, you pour the cement in. Bob's your uncle. You've got a really nice pier. But yeah. And it's probably true that there's not a lot of reusing formwork, when you're working with a modern architect and every project is individual, right? I mean, the whole custom design thing, you're paying for exclusivity. You're not paying for a more expensive construction technique. It's a cheap construction technique. It's the exclusivity that makes it expensive. Quentin reminding me the Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch. I am very well aware, believe me. But speaking of concrete constructions, the dam that holds back one of the largest reservoirs in Europe has been breached. Now, the remarkable thing is the Russians are claiming it wasn't them. The Russians are claiming the Kakhovka Dam was breached by the Ukrainians in order to cut off the water supply to Crimea. This falls down on a couple of counts. The first count is that, frankly, the people in the Kremlin don't care what happens to the people in Crimea. You know, they're always very solicitous of, oh, well, the poor oppressed Russian speakers in Ukraine, when it befits them, their purposes to do so. But once they've gotten whatever advantages to be gained out of that, they forget those people. You know, the current Russian government is not above committing war crimes against its own citizens. We already know this. So the whole thing is rather ludicrous. But perhaps more to the point, both from a strategic and from a tactical point of view, it would be absolutely ludicrous for the Ukrainians to do. From the tactical point of view, because their plan, a counteroffensive against Russia, they've had to divert a lot of the forces and supplies and resources, material and personnel that they were going to use for that, just to evacuating people from the flooded region and other forms of flood relief. It's really adding to the crisis in Ukraine, the burden on the economy, and so on. Apparently the only good thing about it is the flooding has washed away some of the landmines the Russians planted. And then from a strategic point of view, the Kakhovka Dam, this enormous dam with its enormous hydroelectric plant and its enormous irrigation works, is, you know, one of the things they've been planning to recapture from the Russians. It was a very valuable national asset, which they were hoping to get back intact. And now, well, that's... nope. Gonna take a whole hell of a lot of work just to repair the hole, much less make the thing operational again. Now, it's possible that this was not intentional on the part of the Russians, because there have been numerous reports of the Russians occupying the Kakhovka hydroelectric plant are absolutely incompetent and have started a number of fires and so on just because they don't know what they're doing. Apparently they didn't bring in Russian hydroelectric engineers, who are among the best in the world. They just gave it to the hands of the infantry, who are 19-year-old conscripts who don't know their ass from their elbow. Now, some people have been saying, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is threatened. That's bullshit. As I've told you before, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is in cold shutdown status. It requires very little cooling water, although its cooling water is drawn, in principle, from the Kakhovka Reservoir. It's got its own cooling pond on site, which, without the reactors running, is good for months. And you know what months from now is? Winter. There's absolutely nothing that needs cooling in a Ukrainian winter, believe me. Just your note that, and unfortunately the Ukrainian government is doing this. You know, they're spreading the idea that some horrible nuclear catastrophe is going to occur because it's a useful propaganda point against the Russians. But in the larger picture, it's a really bad idea to go around spreading notions like that. Another thing I saw in the Wall Street Journal was a thing about, farmers insurance employees ready to revolt after a change in policy. They got a new CEO who says, the promises you were made about how you'd be work from home from now on, no, you got to come into the office. You got to come into the office. And, you know, people are threatening to quit in droves. The Wall Street Journal writer, with a horror which is appropriate to a Wall Street Journal writer, says, some are even talking about unionizing! as if that were the most extreme thing you could ever possibly imagine doing. But that's the thing, to Wall Street Journal readers, the readers they are targeted at, and therefore to Wall Street Journal writers, you know, that's unionizing is far worse than, say, converting to Molech worship and, you know, burning children alive as sacrifices to your demon god. Unionizing. What a horrible, extreme thing to do. But it points out something, that the American, in America, there's a kind of constant tension between workers who just want to do their jobs and get paid, and executives who are people with some kind of personality dysfunction, which makes them very, very hungry for adulation. They want at all times to be praised. The people who become business executives in America are people who have a really strong need at all times to be praised. And the easiest way for them to obtain this praise is by surrounding themselves with people who have to praise them or lose their livelihoods. And to a great extent, I think that's what this whole return to the office thing is about. Call me a cynic if you like, but I see this as happening. So, a bigger thing that I wanted to talk about today. So yeah, that Dorlisa Fleur thing. I mean, maybe that is really a person's name, but it's like, holy cow. This sure reads like it was written by a chatbot. But, no, there are a couple of pieces. One in the Wall Street Journal, one in the local paper, that I'll read to you just a bit. One of them, the one in the Wall Street Journal, comes under the headline, Companies Rethink Embrace of Social Issues. Firms evaluate decisions, develop crisis plans in case of backlash. In May, clothing company The North Face released a video for Pride Month featuring drag performer Patty Gonia. The ad was similar to the one the performer appeared in for the outdoor apparel maker a year earlier. The reaction was not. Within hours, calls for a boycott of the company spread on social media. The North Face wants to be the next Bud Light, one user wrote. Aren't you supposed to learn from others' mistakes? Another user said. CEOs spent the last few years adjusting to a world in which investors, customers, and employees expected corporate leaders to align themselves with social causes. Today, that has made companies targets in the U.S. culture wars, where one step can turn a social media storm into a corporate crisis that cripples businesses and wrecks careers. Some CEOs are rethinking how or whether to weigh in on sensitive political or social matters with trans and other LGBT issues, particularly in the spotlight. At PPG Industries, a Pittsburgh maker of glidden paint, coatings, and other products, chief executive Tim Knavish, his name is literally Knavish, K-N-A-V-I-S-H, Knavish, asked senior leaders of the company earlier this year to review its processes for engaging in polarizing topics. So many political and cultural issues have ensnared companies, Knavish said, that he wanted the company anyway. And it continues to another page. Now, in the Star Telegram, Fort Worth Star Telegram, on Thursday, on the same page where the meteorologist promised there was absolutely no chance of rain until Monday, and then at 4:55 p.m. on Thursday, I was being rained on. There was a thunderstorm. It was only about a five-minute thunderstorm, but it was a very definite thunderstorm. Anyway, critics blast mayor over removal of Pride Reading Challenge. Roughly 40 members of Fort Worth's LGBTQ+ community packed the city council chamber Tuesday, calling on Mayor Matty Parker to reinstate the Pride badge as part of a city-sponsored reading challenge. The badge had been included as part of the mayor's summer reading program since 2020, but Parker pushed to remove the optional activity after it received pushback from some residents. The faith-based political advocacy group For Liberty and Justice put out a call on May 24th opposing inclusion of the badge because saying it promoted an anti-biblical agenda. A post on the group's Instagram page, blah blah blah. Now, I'm going to make a note here. Anybody who talks about an anti-biblical worldview really needs to define their terms, because people have very different ideas of what a biblical worldview is. Some people see the Bible as saying, you know, love your enemies, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit those in prison. Others see a biblical worldview as requiring them to believe that the earth is square and stationary. So I don't think there's any consensus on what a biblical worldview is. But a sane person might recall that the United States is a society in which we generally have a consensus that because there are so many different religious persuasions, it's not the business of the government to promote any of them. And therefore, if you think the government is pushing an anti-biblical worldview, you know, that's generally agreed to be irrelevant to the business of government. That there are many people in the United States who don't regard a biblical worldview as desirable. They don't regard the Bible, whatever version of it you're referring to, because of course there are different versions, right? They don't regard the Bible as divinely inspired anyway, and they want to know what a bunch of Bronze Age hooey is doing making public policy. And those people are citizens just as much as everyone else is. And so complaining because the government isn't pushing what you think of as a biblical worldview is not really viable in the United States, except that the political circumstances are such that people who feel that way feel entitled to be the ones in charge of such things, I guess you'd say. But I don't know. So my whole point on mentioning this, however, is the part that's not being talked about, because most people don't ever realize it. And it is the idea of cleanness and uncleanness. You know, every religion, for example, has ideas, pretty much, has ideas of ritual purity and impurity. There are things you can't do, not because of any real-world consequences, but because they're seen as unclean. And the truth is, it's not just religions. Every worldview has this category of unclean. And if there's nothing in it, somebody or something will get pigeonholed into it. Across medieval Europe, you know, the Jewish population was often regarded as unclean. They fell into this category of things that were other and not to be trusted and so on. Which, of course, you know, the fact that Jewish identity since the time of the Babylonian captivity has historically been defined by this idea of separateness, of keeping apart, made that all the easier. But in places where there wasn't a Jewish population, along the Bay of Biscay, southern France, northern Spain, there was another outcast, another outgroup. It was just invented from whole cloth, apparently. There was this whole thing. It's so bizarre. I'm not going to go into it right now, except to say that there was a whole fraction of the population where, you know, it was forbidden to ring church bells at their funerals and all kinds of other things. And no one has ever been able to figure out how these people were distinguished from the rest of the population. But they were marked out as an outcast. And so there are acts and there are people that get defined as unclean. And this is a really efficient way of short-circuiting thought, because people don't think. You convince somebody that something is unclean, and then they have a visceral reaction to it. Right. They have a reaction which occurs before the conscious mind has a chance to engage. And so they just reject whatever or whoever without considering it. And as you can imagine, this is an enormously powerful political tool. And you know, some people say, oh no, Godwin's law, you're invoking the Nazis. Well, that's the thing. I'm going to talk about the Nazis because they did a very good job, in their horrible way, of leveraging this idea of uncleanness, this stigma which clung to Jews and gypsies and homosexuals, right? All kinds of people. And of course, the tactics that we're looking at here, the stochastic terrorism, the things where you have politicians who just need to be shoved a little bit, you know, you show up, you know, some people who are doing violence to say, we don't want these Jews in our community, or we don't want Jewish-owned businesses, or whatever. And then you have politicians who are biased, right, already in that direction, and they say, ah, well, you see, there's a groundswell of public outrage, we need to ban Jewish-owned businesses. And it's the exact same thing here. It's, there's a groundswell of public outrage, we need to ban, you know, gay people. Ah, whatever, right? Thing is, do we need to make laws that make it so that going to the bathroom is a criminal offense? Here's the thing. If you ever wonder, right, if you ever wonder, what is gay pride all about, right? Why do these pride parades, etc.? The reason that that exists is this idea of uncleanness. That these are people who, as people or things that they habitually do, right, have been stigmatized as unclean, and so their way of fighting back, beginning particularly in the 1970s, their way of fighting back was to be very visible and vocal and say, no, I'm not unclean. I don't have anything to be ashamed of for being the way I am, for doing the things that I do. Right, that's the heart and soul of the whole pride phenomenon, which is hard to understand for most people simply because it's never, almost never, expressed out loud. That it's a way of fighting the stigma of uncleanness by simple rejection, not by trying to argue. Right? Not by trying to argue, but by simple confrontation. Because the thing is, you can't argue about uncleanness, because as I said before, it short-circuits the cognitive function, right? It's a way for politicians and other manipulators to get around your thinking mind. Now, this is really important, because it's one of the major traps that we have to think about. You know, it's one of the things that can lead to major wars. It's one of the things that is very dangerous for humanity. And, as it turns out, social media echo chambers, people say that phrase all the time, but they are really good at propagating this concept of uncleanness. Anyway, the thing is, that's also the way that nuclear energy is seen by many people. You know, you can present all the facts you want. You can argue all you want, but people aren't going to change their minds about nuclear energy because they have been indoctrinated that it is unclean. And they'll talk about radioactivity or nuclear waste or something, but that's not what the real question is. The real question is very abstract. Right, because ritual purity and impurity, cleanness and uncleanness, have very little to do. For all that people try to say, well, the, you know, Jewish law forbidding eating pork has to do with trichinosis or whatever. No, purity and impurity in a ritual sense, cleanness and uncleanness, have very little to do with anything that happens in the physical observable world. As a matter of fact, some of the pro-nuclear environmentalists have taken to holding nuclear pride rallies, the whole purpose of which is, again, to come out and say, I'm for nuclear energy, I'm not ashamed of being for nuclear energy, nuclear energy is a good thing, and the people who say it's not should have to justify their position instead of me having to justify my position, which is the one supported by the facts. Anyway, you've been listening to A Step Farther Out on AnonRadio.net, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and I'm likely to read them out over the air. In fact, I got a nice piece of mail from Tobe the other day, including a Korean chick tract, but there's not really much to read out to you unless you want to see me try to pronounce Korean, which you really don't.
7.